It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Bickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we'll learn about the life and career of Wisconsin native Frederick March.
First, U.S. officials confirmed yesterday that a video showing the beheading of an American journalist, James Foley, by a member of the militant group ISIS is authentic. In the video, Foley cites the United States air campaign against ISIS as the reason for his beheading.
President Obama launched that campaign on August 8th, and he spoke to the nation yesterday about James Foley's murder. Here's what he had to say.
ISIL has no ideology of any value to human beings. Their ideology is bankrupt. And they may claim out of expediency that they are at war with the United States or the West, but the fact is they terrorize their neighbors and offer them nothing but an endless slavery to their empty vision and the collapse of any definition of civilized behavior.
He followed up with comments about the United States' response.
The United States of America will continue to do what we must do to protect our people. We will be vigilant and we will be relentless. When people harm Americans anywhere, we do what's necessary to see that justice is done. And we act against ISIL, standing alongside others.
Douglas Ollivant joins us now to talk about the United States' response to ISIL so far and what we can expect moving forward. He's a senior national security fellow with the New America Foundation and former director for Iraq at the National Security Council during both the Bush and Obama administrations. Douglas, thanks for joining us.
Thanks. Good afternoon, Veronica.
Well, how significant is the murder and the message behind ISIS's murder of U.S. journalist James Foley to the United States?
I don't think this really changes anything except a level of awareness. Certainly, no one that I know who follows ISIL was very shocked by this event. This is very much in their character, in their nature. This is a brutal group that, you know, we've seen does crucifixions, buried Yazidi children alive, was running slave markets, massacring people. So this really shouldn't surprise us. This is well within the range of how they operate. But I think this has struck home with the American people in a way that what happened to the Yazidis was a little more at the level of theory to a lot of people. This obviously hits very close to home.
And here in Wisconsin, Senator Ron Johnson is going to be holding town hall meetings in the state to raise awareness about ISIL and the threat that they pose to the United States. Is this appropriate at this time? Do we need to be concerned here in America about the threat of ISIL, maybe on the homeland?
Regrettably, I think we do. As we've seen, if you watch the video or watch some excerpt of the video, this is a brutal group. I mean, there are terrorist groups. You know, Hamas is a terrorist group, but Hamas doesn't bury people alive. They don't run slave markets. They don't massacre people, you know, as a group, as a people. They don't conduct genocide. This is a group of a different nature than your, you know, garden variety terrorist group, though those are still bad and evil and to be discouraged. So it's something of a different character, and they have a large number of Westerners. We estimate there are scores, around 100, give or take, Americans who are affiliated with ISIL, and as many as 1,000 Europeans, you know, who have passports where they can go through American customs without a visa, without much screening. So there's a very serious threat to our homeland. I think it's very clear that ISIL wants to be the big kid on the block when it comes to Islamic jihadism. They are clearly in competition with al-Qaeda. What distinguishes al-Qaeda from ISIS is that al-Qaeda has struck the American homeland and ISIL has not. I suspect that they want to change that.
So what do we do about it at this point? We've got airstrikes going on in Iraq, and that's something that could continue for the long term. But in terms of keeping out threats to America who may have passports, American citizens, how do we do that?
Well, that's going to require a lot of cooperation. It's going to require intelligence services in each of these countries to be a little more vigilant about their people who are going to known access points to move into ISIL. You know, to get to Iraq or Syria, very few of these people are just going to fly in there. They're probably mostly going to go to Turkey and move across the border into Syria. or go into Jordan and move across the border. So we should be able to track those people who move there. We should be able to do the same with American citizens. But it's going to require a lot of vigilance and a lot of intelligence sharing between all these countries.
And do you think the president responded appropriately, given the fact that, as you said, this did touch a nerve for the American public for good reason? Did the president do what he can to assuage fears?
I think the president is doing a remarkably good job managing this crisis. There's obviously nothing we can do for Mr. Foley now. I don't think there's anything we can do for his companion either. I mean, they're in the hands of ISIL, and I don't think we have any idea where in the deserts of Syria or Iraq these people might be. So all we can do now is prevent further harm or try to prevent further harm. And I think the president is also trying to raise awareness among the American people that this is a very real threat. And even though this threat is largely in Iraq, which all of us would like to never have any military engagement with again, nonetheless, there is this terrorist safe haven growing in Iraq that is a threat to our homeland, and we may have to do something about it.
Well, as you say, there's no appetite for a very intense involvement in Iraq, and yet this is where ISIL, where ISIS has taken root for a large part in Syria as well. So in terms of the U.S. response, what have the airstrikes accomplished so far?
Well, what they've accomplished so far is they've prevented ISIS from spreading further. They've not been able to move towards Erbil. They've not been able to move towards Baghdad. And when they took the Mosul Dam, we were able to push them off of that. I think that what we saw in the Mosul Dam operation may have been a proof of concept for how we want to do this in the future. We saw Iraqi government forces in conjunction with Kurdish forces fighting on the ground against ISIS or ISIL or Daesh or the Islamic State. Those are all equivalent terms. With U.S. air power in providing support. And with the U.S. air power, both the Iraqi army units and the Kurds did substantially better than they had done in the past against the Islamic State or ISIS. I think that's our proof of concept moving forward. Now, a lot of the other places that the Islamic State may have to be engaged, the cities like Mosul and Tikrit, are going to be much harder than was Mosul Dam. There were no civilians around Mosul Dam. There were no buildings to hide in. It was hard for them to dig in there. So that was a relatively easy place for us to expel the Islamic State from. But I think that still showed that that's the preferred technique that we're going to want to have moving forward, like we did in Mosul Dam or something on the Libya model, where the Iraqis or other forces, we've had the PKK has been helping. That's a Kurdish group in Turkey. That's actually a designated terrorist group, but they were part of the group that helped rescue the Yazidis, so we seem to be okay with that. Perhaps forces out of Syria. I think it'll be whoever's willing to help us fight on the ground against ISIS or ISIL, we may be willing to help provide air power for.
And President Obama has said that ISIS is a cancer that he'd like to see the world rid of. Is there any plan on the table to do that, to eradicate ISIS, or are we just sort of controlling damage right now?
Well, we're certainly controlling damage right now, and I think we need to be aware that this is something we're going to have to live with. Now, we don't have to live with them controlling large pieces of territory in Iraq and Syria, and I think that's something the president is going to engage the American people about fixing. But, this cancer is not going away anytime soon. There are deep root causes that eventually we'll have to worry about. We're not in root causes mode right now. Right now we're in dealing with these terrorists who slaughter people and run slave markets and behead journalists, and that's appropriate. Once we get to the point where they're pushed back, then we can start thinking about root causes in the region.
Douglas, do you expect to see more involvement from the U.S. in terms of military might, more than airstrikes?
I think the president is going to be remarkably reticent to put U.S. forces on the ground in Iraq for all types of very obvious historical reasons. That's just still an open wound in the American body politic. We still have not resolved what we think as a whole about the war in Iraq, and we still fight about it a lot. So it's hard for me to see him committing ground troops in any serious way. Advisors at Embassy Baghdad, advisors at some of these senior military headquarters where their chances of getting overrun or captured are very, very close to zero. Yes, something like that. Putting American troops into combat, probably not.
We'll leave it there, Douglas. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much, Veronica.
That was Douglas Ollivant, Senior National Security Fellow with the New America Foundation and former director for Iraq at the National Security Council during both the Bush and the Obama administrations.
Only one actor has won both the Academy Award and the Tony Award twice. It was Frederick March, who was born in Racine on August 31st, 1897.
March attended UW-Madison and went on to star in major films from the 30s through the 60s. He won an Oscar for his title roles in Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
How is Frederick March remembered today? We'll find out from Jim Healy. He's the director of the film programming for the UW-Madison Film Coalition Cinematheque. Jim, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, give us a little bit of Frederick March 101. Who was he?
Well, he was born Frederick Bickle in Racine, and I think he was one of the great, great actors of the first 30, 40 years or so of sound cinema, certainly regarded as one of the great actors of the theater, too, although we don't have too many records of his theatrical performances today. We can certainly see his film work. He was a classic leading man, but he had a kind of extra layer of tenderness and vulnerability that came through, whether he was playing fathers or authoritarian figures or even villains in some cases.
And somewhere along the way, he went from Bickle to March. Is that his Hollywood name? Did he become Frederick March instead of
No, Bickle? It was something he took as a stage name. He was acting in the theater mainly during the 1920s, and he changed his name at that time. I guess, and you can imagine why.
it's a little more,
It reminded too many people of Pickle, I think. So.
I see. Well, let's talk a little bit about his connection to the UW-Madison. How did he end up here?
Well, he didn't come here right out of high school. He worked for 2 years in Racine as a banker, and he wound up here in Madison just after he turned 19, I think, and started school in 1916, rather. He was born in 1897, and studied commerce here as a continuation of his work as a banker. But soon he joined a drama society and had a little vaudeville act going with a friend. And eventually he was cast as a lead in the Edmond Rostand play, The Romancers, here. And he caught the theater bug here at the University of Wisconsin.
And what was his first big break?
Well, there's a couple, I think. I think for the big role that got him into movies was a play he did on Broadway by Moss Hart and Edna Ferber called The Royal Family. And it was a thinly veiled depiction of the Barrymore family, Ethel Barrymore and John Barrymore, who were the best known actors of the time. It was a comedy. And in the play, March played a character based on John Barrymore. And it was very popular. Eventually, it went on tour, went to Hollywood, where it was seen by all sorts of casting agents and studio personnel. And he got a contract at Paramount Pictures just at the dawn of the sound era, signed at Paramount, and did, I think, something like a dozen films in his first 2 years under contract at Paramount, one of which was the film adaptation of The Royal Family. So that was a big break, but I think the film that kind of launched him into international stardom was his 1933 version of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, directed by the great and innovative filmmaker Ruben Mamoulian. And in the film, March plays both parts, of course, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and went through an elaborate kind of makeup process. But he was compelling in both roles. And it was a big hit at a time when horror films were big box office here in the U.S. and all over the world, Frankenstein, Dracula, and the like, and it became a big smash, and it won him his first Academy Award for Best Actor.
All right, so what won him his second?
That was for The Best Years of Our Lives, which is one of the quintessential films of the 1940s, if not of all time. William Wyler film, from 1946, a really beloved film. I'm sure most people know it, about returning war veterans after World War II. And he plays one of three main characters in the film, three returning vets. And his is the least, I'd say, the least showy part. He plays the older senior member of the three veterans. And it's a part with, you know, a lot of sensitivity and understanding and compassion. And I think it just, you know, really moved a lot of people, as did the film. His one of his co-stars, who played one of the other soldiers, Harold Russell, who was a real-life disabled veteran after the war, won the Best Supporting Actor Oscar that year.
You mentioned the broad array of parts that he could play, the types of characteristics he could convey on screen, and I imagine that came to his advantage during Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Where did he hone his skills as an actor?
That's hard to say. I think he was a big fan of film and theater. He went to see a lot of plays and movies throughout his life. He was a big disciple of John Barrymore. He really admired him a lot, who had played Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde in the 20s. Perhaps it was just being a good Midwesterner that made him a kind of everyman. You know, he was a very handsome guy, but at the same time, he could play, you know, someone very distorted, like Mr. Hyde. You know.
Well, turning to his career on Broadway, he turned down, apparently, the part of Willie Loman in the original Broadway production of Death of a Salesman. Why?
That's right. He had been very busy. This was 1949, and he just came off making three movies in a row, all co-starring his wife, Florence Eldridge, who was an accomplished actress herself. The last film he had done of the three was an international production, Christopher Columbus, which took him to Europe, and he came back to the States, and he just felt he was too tired to accept such a demanding role. He was thrilled to be asked, and he recognized what a great and potential role it was, but he turned it down, and later said he regretted it. But eventually, when they made a movie of it in 1951, he accepted that and was nominated for another Academy Award for playing Willie Loman in the screen version.
And we hear actors today who have done some television and film and then go on to do Broadway that the two are so different. Was that true back in Frederick March's day? And was he as big a success on Broadway as he was in films?
I think he was as big a success. He had, you know, his ups and downs. He could do three or four plays in a row, just as he could do three or four movies in a row that would be failures, that would not draw an audience. But then he could do something like, made the very first portrayal of James Tyrone Sr. in the very first production ever of Long Day's Journey into Night, which he played for, I think he performed in for well over a year. And this is a four-hour play, and exhausting and grueling. And I think it's because of this that he found theater to be much more tiring than movie work.
When you look at his career, he, in the 30s, was acting with some of the biggest stars there were, Gary Cooper, Greta Garbo, Olivia de Havilland. And yet, I don't often hear his name mentioned in their company. Do you think that time has forgotten him, or is he still remembered as he should be?
I hope not. Some of the films are certainly wonderful and should be viewed, and I'm sure some of them still are. His Jean Valjean and Les Miserables is tremendous. It's the 1935 version of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and well into the 40s and the 50s and even the 60s, too. He's in some terrific films like Executive Suite, The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit, Inherit the Wind, and a terrific mid-60s Western called Hombre with Paul Newman. And then he capped his film career. In fact, I think it was the last role he ever performed as Harry Hope in the film version of The Iceman Cometh in 1974 with Robert Ryan and Lee Marvin.
Well, in our last moments here, if there's one film we should check out that that stars Frederick March, what would you recommend?
Oh, that's so hard. Well, we didn't talk about comedies, and he did a handful of comedies that were really terrific. And just last night, I watched Nothing Sacred again, which is a screwball comedy where he played opposite Carol Lombard. And it's on Netflix, and it's 73 minutes, and it goes by like a breeze, and it's extremely funny. All right, I recommend it.
We'll check it out. Thank you, Jim, for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Jim Healy is the Director of Film Programming for Cinematheque, a coalition of UW-Madison departments dedicated to finding and showing important films that would otherwise not be available. As we're gearing up for the start of the school year, many districts in Wisconsin are rolling out new teacher compensation models in compliance with Act 10.
These models are performance-based and take student outcomes into consideration. Some teachers are worried that the new models are too subjective and too heavy-handed.
Here to talk with us about how the new compensation models will change the education landscape is Steve Correa. He's the chair of education and a professor of education at St. Catherine University. Steve, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, very glad to be here. Thank you.
Well, let's start by talking about how teacher pay has worked historically. What have previous pay models been like for teachers?
Yeah, and I think that's a natural place to start. You know, just teacher pay in and of itself is usually at a minimum half of a district's budget, and sometimes, you know, 75% to 80%. So the topic is very important to administrators, superintendents, of course, and the person that's taking home the paycheck. But when we look historically, unfortunately, some people look at teacher compensation and automatically assume today's model was invented yesterday. And so they blame it on whether it's unions or whatever the case, and they sort of forget there's a nice long history here. Anybody listening that watched the Little House on the Prairie series might remember, and I think her name was Miss Beadle, but I wasn't a huge watcher.
I think so.
Okay.
It's been a while.
Sometimes, you know, those teachers, they were paid in food. Sometimes they had to skin the animal themselves, and boarding. And that was the sum total of their compensation. Maybe a little extra pay. I don't know if they went to Olson's Mercantile or not. But but the analogy is, or the example is pretty darn correct. It was meager, get-by subsistence. And it just simply reflected we had to have somebody watch these children teach basic skills, and we're done. As the evolution of education came about and the teaching profession, we developed probably more about to the 1920s, 1930s, and some of the more rural areas, models that paid high school teachers more or much more, elementary school teachers less. But the idea was maybe the high school teachers had more education. Maybe they actually had a four-year degree or a normal school degree. And, I have to admit, when I was in second grade, I had a teacher that did not have a teaching degree, Mrs. Klessa. I happen to think she walked on water, and I learned to read well with her. But clearly, she must have made less than the other teachers. And I'm not ancient, and I wasn't born before Sputnik. So it's not that old. But that model existed because, again, the education system was maturing, and we were reflecting some of the changes in higher education and our expectations for learning and knowledge on the part of teachers and skills. Now we're in what some researchers have called a single salary schedule. And that's probably a better title than descriptor, but the idea is basically everybody comes in at X salary, and then you gradually move through what we used to think of as a salary schedule. Oh, you have 2 years experience and a master's degree, and you go down the matrix this way and that way. So it reflects somewhat the more nuanced expectations of increased professionalism in the field, degrees, ongoing professional development. And now we are in, because of Act 10 in Wisconsin, this post-single salary schedule because school boards no longer have to do that. And that's how we then come upon this topic today. They're trying to say, how do we do this? How do we fairly reward our teachers? And how do we get the best bang for our buck with what is at least two-thirds of the school budget? The question is right on the nose. The outcomes are usually not very well informed.
Well, how did these salary schedules compare district to district in recent past?
And some districts just have very nice compensation schedules. Now, just for audience members, you know, listeners out there, teachers in Nassau County, New York, probably don't have a lot of listeners from there, but did you know that they can make almost $100,000 a year? Public school teachers. I'm positive they work hard. They reflect high levels of training expectations. They have to have advanced skill sets. But in some states, public school starting teachers start in the mid-$20,000. Now, how's that for a range with what we expect people to do within schools? That's quite a bit. In Wisconsin, some of the more affluent school districts that have been able to support with levies, other types of support, for example, Kohler has done very well. They're an exempted school district. They have accepted these higher taxes to be able to have an independent school district. Shoreview, some of the other exceptional districts, Appleton is a very strong district. Some of the more Tony suburbs of Milwaukee, Sun Prairie, they have very strong salary schedules. They get very strong teachers. But some of the rural districts, they are financially strapped. So they have a hard time attracting, especially those underserved areas, say special ed licenses, math, science. Physics teachers come in about as often as Venus on the half shell. So they are very difficult to find.
Well, and with Act 10 coming into effect, it sounds like wages can only be negotiated to the rate of inflation, that raises can be negotiated to the rate of inflation. Does that even things out at all?
And of course, the key word in that is negotiated. Can you imagine not even getting the rate of inflation? And that happens because that's a perfectly legal thing for districts to do. So what has happened is districts now are looking at things like signing bonuses for whether teachers with strong track records, strong leadership records, perhaps multiple licenses. If you can get a math, physics, Spanish teacher, that's a valuable person. So students going through teacher education programs need to know that the days of coming out, I'm going to teach elementary education, and I'm going to be with social studies. Well, you know, you're not in a position to negotiate very much. So some districts are much more strongly positioned to take advantage of market forces, and other districts are going to be woefully left behind because they just can't compete.
And talk a little bit about how teacher reviews happen and how the, as I understand it, it will be based mostly on student performance. Is that correct?
And that is exactly right. The current model reflects the values and the culture of schools, or I should say the pre-Act 10 model. And what that did, you know, teachers saw that no one teacher educated that child. The building, the professionals did. And they didn't try to tease out, well, my effect was 43% of his score. They all realized it was a social enterprise to educate that child. Well, some districts now are looking at very narrow but specific quantifiable outcomes of student assessments to be able to tie it to either incentive pay or, quite frankly, to teacher pay. The whole ball of wax. And, these are the ones I wish that if anybody is listening, they could direct these people to an outstanding resource in the state of Wisconsin, and we're talking gold standard, is the Consortium for Policy Research and Education. And it's right there on the Madison campus. These people do work that is phenomenal. And they're rarely referred to by districts looking at what are viable models. And they do, they talk about models that exist around the country and what we want to do. Colorado has a system that's a very well thought out post single salary system, and it has areas where it doesn't include student achievement and increases in it, but it also recognized professional development skills in teachers. They are evaluated by principals, and then how that teacher contributes to the overall mission of the school. So there are ways and models out there that exist, but if a district is looking at narrow measures, which anybody in industry would probably say they gave that up in the 1970s, narrow measures, they're looking at broad measures, employee input, participation, ownership, it builds morale. So, you know, districts, people proposing these narrow performance measures really need to inform themselves that A, it's an old model, and B, there are good places to go for information right in the state of Wisconsin.
We're talking to education expert Steve Correa about new teacher compensation models in the state.
And we want to hear from you on this. Do you think it makes sense to pay teachers based on performance? Teachers, are you experiencing a change in the way that you're going to be paid? What is it based on? Call in and tell us about it. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And you can also send us an email to talk@wpr.org. We're continuing our conversation with education expert Steve Correa about new post-Act 10 teacher compensation models, which are getting off the ground here in Wisconsin.
And we're taking your calls. What do you think of a more performance-based compensation model for teachers? Is it a good idea or not, and why? Teachers, we want to hear from you, too. Are you in a district where the way that you're paid is changing? Have you moved into another district because of hiring incentives there? Let us know at 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Steve, before the break, we were talking about ways in which to measure a teacher's performance, and you were saying that these are narrow measurements, but I want to talk about, based on student performance, that is, I want to talk about whether or not student performance is based then, therefore, directly on standardized testing scores and that sort of thing. How intertwined are standardized tests with teacher performance?
And usually, most of the models that other states are looking at, they almost all, geez, I can't think of one that doesn't, they all include aspects of student performance on standardized tests. They're consistent measures to be able to use. So, you know, administrators like them because it's a nice black and white number, and you can kind of stare at it and say, "Oh, look where you fall." The limitations of those are that it might not reflect the growth from last year to this year or what has happened in the intervening time. That does not dismiss that number. That number must be looked at in a context. And teachers are saying just a number, that's not the picture. There are a variety of inputs that we need to look here, let alone test anxiety on the student's part, but okay, that might be. But the idea is that you want to look at multiple measures of teaching effectiveness, just as we do for all employees. And we want to be able to do that. So teachers are just saying, there's lots going on here. Let's look at as many of these as we can. And that's what professionals do. They discuss back and forth what the measures are, what the inputs, how much do we attention do we give to this. Let's look at other responsibilities, duties, you know, those kind of things. And so it's a menu and a range of expectations. So standardized test scores are a portion, but they are a portion. They're not the entirety of what you're hoping to measure.
Who exactly is measuring teacher performance?
Oftentimes, these people should really be nominated for sainthood most of the time, building principals have so much coming at them, and a large part of the new race to the top if indeed that's really what ends up sticking around. But the idea is that building principals are responsible for their teachers, and they're responsible for measuring their teachers. So most building principals have not had the training and the expertise in these multivariate analysis. Anybody taking a statistics course just rolled their eyes. With this idea of, wow, multiple inputs, different effect levels from these inputs, how much of this? Principals are going from one room to the next, and they've got a parent call, and they've got this, and they've got books, and they have a lot coming at them. So everybody is looking for something efficient and quick, and teachers are saying that's not right, it's not proper, and it doesn't reflect what we do. So we need to come up with a model that works and that appropriately recognizes and rewards strong, effective teacher behavior. So that's what they're trying to do.
Let's take a call from Camille in New Berlin. Hi, Camille.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm a retired teacher, and I can tell you, as a proctoring the tests for eighth grade and high school, that many of these kids know that these tests have no effect on their grade. They're passing from one level to another, and they just whip through them as quickly as possible. Why not do the same thing for a dentist? Dentists. If your kid gets cavities, your children, your patients get cavities, you don't get paid as well. Obesity, if you're a pediatrician, you should take a pay cut. Because that's basically what you're doing to teachers.
Thanks, Camille. Steve Correa, what's your response to
that? Yeah, I like Camille. You know, it might be helpful to know that Medicare is clearly moving very much away from inputs with patients, and they're now looking at outcomes. In fact, some people listening may know, hospitals 99.9% of the time do not get compensated for readmissions for the same medical condition because they have to do it right the first time. So, what she's saying is we need to figure out ways to be able to incentivize students to do well on these tests, and we need to find authentic measures of student learning that do matter, that do resonate, that do reflect expertise of teachers and the culture of the school. By the way, no easy matter. You can see why principals, strong principals, are so phenomenal. But, you know, other places are looking at this, and they are tying compensation to outcomes that are specific and are not repetitious. So we do need to, so hospitals have the incentive to get it right the first time. And what we're trying to do here with teachers is we're trying to find ways to be able to respect and reflect that input of their professionalism within teaching and then have students understand the role of all of this. So, yeah, you can see it's a complex dynamic. I have no doubt that what she observed isn't a consistent behavior across many eighth grade classrooms.
You said earlier that older models of teaching, of teacher pay, honored the fact that teaching is a social enterprise. Do you think these new models will change the culture of teaching?
Well, you know, it puts it at risk, and that is clear. It puts it at risk. Teachers are very open to, I want to bring in the reading specialist. I want to bring in the special needs person. Well, the student isn't designated with a special need area. However, I know that they have expertise that can help. And the special needs people, the speech pathologist, they come in, they help. Well, we're now changing the values from the emphasis on this child and this idea of a more equitable, even distribution of compensation to strong market forces reflecting individual behavior. Teachers don't think that way initially. And, of course, you know, there in Madison, R1 institutions, high professors there of research institutions, they are rewarded for publication, bringing in grants, and working with grad students. Colleges, wonderful colleges in the state, St. Norbert College, Beloit College, Lawrence University, they have a very different pay scale they do not overtly pay, you know, economics professors more. They probably do pay them more because they're hard to get, because they colleges have a different culture. We're all educating these bachelor degree undergraduate students together. So it's a different culture, it's a different incentive system, and therefore it's a different reward structure. Schools, you're putting that at risk when you are doing this. So that's one of those caveats of unintended consequences. School boards and superintendents need to do this thoughtfully. It can be done. The Colorado model that I mentioned is mentioned. There's evidence to show that it's pretty effective. But they really need to inform what they're doing and not deduce that the current model is union-derived, therefore it rewards lack of motivation on people and it's evil. So anyway, it does put it at risk, and so it has to be entered into carefully.
In our last minute here, how do you see this playing out across the country? Is Wisconsin setting the standard?
Well, I don't want to say that there's a race in the wrong direction, but Wisconsin, of course, is the first one to blow up the existing model and to take away that idea of the compensation model. Perhaps something really strong will come out of it, and that would be impressive. But if it's a model to save money for districts, no. If it's a model to engage teachers in inputs, to look at ways to build a reward structure for good, effective teaching, there's a possibility.
Steve, thank you so much for being with us today.
Very glad to be here. Thank you for asking.
That was Steve Correa. He's chair of education and a professor of education at St. Catherine University.